Good morning. Our scripture reading this morning will be from Galatians, the fourth chapter, verses 8 through 9. However, at that time, when you did not know God, you were slaves to those which by nature are no gods. But now that you have come to know God, or rather be known by God, how is it that you turn again back to the weak and worthless elemental things to which you desire to be enslaved all over again? Great to see everybody here this morning. If we have any visitors with us, then I encourage you, please let us know what spiritual need you have. What brought you to us today? What of all the things that you could have done on a Sunday morning where it's kind of gray and cloudy outside and your bed was probably warm and cozy, of all the things you could have done today, you came here to be with Christians and to worship God. And if you have a spiritual need that has driven you to us today, if there's some sin in your life that has brought you down, then please talk to us about that. We'd love to sit down and open up our Bibles together and find out what you need from God. And if there's some way that we can help you to fill that need. Our theme for the year 2020 has been turning the world upside down. It's from the book of Acts. We're going to be in Acts chapter 19, by the way, so if you want to have your Bibles open there, we'll be studying from Acts chapter 19. The theme is all about the idea of the gospel changing your perspective on things, turning the world upside down. Things that you thought were important before are made unimportant by the priorities presented in the gospel. The life that you thought was the life you wanted to live, a life of sin and indulgence, of getting what you want when you want it, a life where you could think the things you wanted and do the things that you wanted, and nobody was going to tell you otherwise. The gospel comes in and says, let's flip that upside down. And really, the true life, the meaningful life, the powerful life, the eternal life, is the one where you give of yourself to other people, where other people, your neighbor, even your enemy, is more important than you are, that God becomes the ultimate priority. Now, the thing about turning the world upside down is that it's a very uncomfortable process. And sometimes, during the process of turning the world upside down, we have to come face to face with the fact that we've been living in error. We've been living a falsehood. We've believed the wrong things and practiced the wrong things. Now, some people are very excited about that because they have always had this deep-seated feeling that no matter how much I'm convinced by it, no matter how much my friends or my peers tell me it's the right way to live, no matter how much of the world believes this is the right way to live, I'm still longing and yearning for something, that there's more meaning to be found out there than money or career or sex or position in society or power, that there's something more out there. Some people are very excited to find out that the gospel can turn their world upside down. But then there are other people, like those we read about in Ephesus in Acts chapter 19, who were facing their world turning upside down and responded irrationally and violently. Acts chapter 19 begins with Paul preaching to the Ephesians. And he seems to have some great success with them, by the way. After some initial trouble confronting the fact of their baptism and whether they had had the Holy Spirit given to them or not, after some conflict with those in the local synagogue, and when it seems like things are finally settling in and settling down in Ephesus for Paul the Apostle and the disciples in that city, there is an uproar in Ephesus. Let's pick up reading here. I know this is not our main text for the day, but let's pick up reading here in verse 16. Paul the Apostle has just helped a man who had been burdened with an evil spirit all these years. And it says in verse 16, the man in whom was the evil spirit leaped on them. These were some false teachers, these seven sons of Sceva, a Jewish chief priest. He leaped on them and subdued them and overpowered them, and they ran out of the house naked and wounded. But this, in verse 17, became known to all, both Jews and Greeks who lived in Ephesus, and fear fell upon them all, and the name of the Lord was being magnified. Many, it says in verse 18, of those who had believed kept coming, confessing and disclosing their practices. That's their sins. They were willing to own up to their sins, take responsibility. They were willing to say, once and for all, that the witchcraft that I've been practicing is wrong, it's false, it's a sin. That the lifestyle that I've been living is a sin. That what I've been teaching other people is wrong. They were finally willing to own up to that and take responsibility. And so it says in verse 19 that many of those who practiced magic brought their books together and began burning them in the sight of all. And they counted up the price of them and found it 50,000 pieces of silver. People were finally willing to put that life behind them. They've been practicing magic and witchcraft and divination. And they took all that they had invested for all those years, and they're just willing to burn it. I guess maybe quick practical application. How much have you invested in your sins? And are you willing to burn that investment? For the sake of being right with God, for the sake of your salvation, for the sake of your eternal soul, are you willing to go ahead and burn all of the investment that you've put into sin? All of the investment that was put into relationships that you cultivated that were bringing out the worst in you? Friendships. Right? Evil companions that corrupted your good morals. 1 Corinthians chapter 15. All of the investment that you've put into sin, would you be willing to just burn it? Or as Paul puts it in the book of Philippians, I counted all of it as rubbish. All of it. Everything that I had before I was a Christian, that I took stock of that was important to me, I count it as rubbish now. Would you be willing to do that? Because the Ephesians were, or at least some of the Ephesians were. The word, it says in verse 20, was growing mightily and prevailing. But that's not the end of the story in Ephesus. Ephesus was famous for something. It was famous for a great temple to the goddess Artemis. In fact, the Ephesians were so proud not only of the temple itself, but of taking care of it, that they considered themselves to be a special people, a unique people in the entire Greek and Roman world. Artemis was their god. Goddess, excuse me. Artemis was their goddess. They loved Artemis. There were special celebrations, there were festivals, there were pilgrims who came from all over the Greek and Roman world to celebrate these festivals, which is probably an indication why the theater in Ephesus could hold 25,000 people. Think about that. 25,000 people could fit into the theater at Ephesus. Why? Because of the festivals, the celebrations. They would put on plays and shows in honor of Artemis. And then there was the temple itself. One writer in the 2nd century BC said this about the temple to Artemis. I have set eyes upon the wall of lofty Babylon on which lies a chariot road, and the statue of Zeus by the Alpheus, and the hanging gardens, the colossus of the sun, the huge labor of the high pyramids, and the vast tomb of Mausolus. But when I saw the temple of Artemis which rose to the clouds, these other marvels lost their brilliance, and I exclaimed, lo, apart from Olympus, the sun has never looked upon aught so grand. The Ephesians loved Artemis, and they believed that Artemis loved them. Essentially, the temple to Artemis was like the great tourist attraction in Ephesus. Now, it was an important port city also, and there was a harbor very close to the main part of the city. And so, of course, there were other things that happened in Ephesus aside from just the temple to Artemis. But if you're thinking about, like, if you asked anyone in the ancient world, like, what do you think of when you hear the name Ephesus? It was the temple to Artemis. Just like this, in maybe modern terms, if I say Anaheim, California, what's the first thing that you think of if I say Anaheim, California? Disneyland, right? Of course, Disneyland. Now, are there other things in Anaheim? Sure, there are hotels and gas stations and subdivisions and all that sort of thing. There's plenty of other things in Anaheim, California. But if you say Anaheim, the first thing that comes to mind, the most important driver of the economy there, the thing that people in Anaheim are, I don't know if they're maybe proud of it or if they just hate the traffic there, but it's Disneyland. The Temple of Artemis was the great tourist attraction in Ephesus. And where there are tourist attractions, there are almost always merchants willing to capitalize on the tourists who are there. This, by the way, is all that's left of the Temple of Artemis. A single column. And what's interesting is that column that you see there, that's not even pieces from one column. That's actually pieces from multiple columns that have been put together to make one column. So all that's left of the Temple of Artemis is a bunch of rocks and pieces of multiple columns put together to make one single column. That's it. That is all that's left of the Temple to Artemis in Ephesus. Now, you can go to various museums, the British Museum being one of them, and you can see little statues and figurines of Artemis herself, or at least a representation of Artemis. She was the goddess of nature. She was the goddess of the hunt. The imagery that surrounded her was that of fertility and nature and abundance, honeybees and honey, oxen and deer and wild animals. And so you can see here that represented on these kinds of figurines and statues. What is on her chest there, although some historians believe there's a sexual connotation to it, most historians believe there's actually a shirt made of eggs. Right, those are eggs on her chest to represent the fertility that's associated with her. And if you look a little bit more closely at her legs, she's adorned in things, again, like oxen and deer, flowers and honeybees. Right, so that's what they thought of with Artemis, was she's the goddess of nature and fertility and wild animals and the hunt and everything like that. So really, that's what you see of Artemis. And similar kinds of figurines would have been made by the merchants in Ephesus, which leads us here to our text in verse 23. Acts chapter 19, verse 23. Now about that time there arose no small disturbance concerning the way, for a certain man named Demetrius, a silversmith, who made silver shrines of Artemis, was bringing no little business to the craftsmen. These he gathered together with the workmen of similar trade and said, "Men, you know that our prosperity depends upon this business." Verse 26, "And you see in here that not only in Ephesus, but in almost all of Asia, this Paul has persuaded and turned away a considerable number of people, saying that gods made with hands are no gods at all." Verse 27, "Not only this, not only is there danger that this trade of ours fall into disrepute, but also that the temple of the great goddess of Artemis be regarded as worthless, and that she whom all of Asia and all the world worship should even be dethroned from her magnificence." Let's take this apart a little bit. Let's unpackage what Demetrius is saying. I'm always wary of people's motives, and I'm not like a naturally cynical person, right? But I am the sort of person, though, that when I'm like walking around the mall or something like that, and a stranger comes up to me with a clipboard and says, "Can I have a minute of your time?" I go, "No." I am the sort of person that when I go to the pyramid downtown, and you're going to Bass Pro Shops in the pyramid, and there's those people selling the timeshares, like right there, I am the sort of person that I will walk like through the apparel department just so I can avoid the people selling the timeshares there. Right? So I'm not a naturally cynical person, but I do think we need to be what Jesus says. We need to be as shrewd as serpents. Like there's just kind of apply a little bit of wisdom and scrutiny to people and their motives. Here's Demetrius saying, "I'm so worried about the great goddess Artemis. Oh, she whom all of Asia and all the world worship, she may fall into disrepute." And You know, there's also the little inconvenient matter of my entire business depends on people coming and worshiping Artemis at this temple. Like, oh, the other shoe dropped. I see now. Part of having our world turned upside down, as was the case here in Ephesus, is we have to start looking at our real motive in things. Why do I believe what I believe? Do I believe what I believe because it's just convenient to believe that thing? Do I believe that because my parents believed it and my grandparents believed it, my great-grandparents believed it? Do I believe it because there are great business connections in the church and I can get clients from other church members? Do I believe what I believe because we have an elegant building in a nice part of town and there's some kind of social cachet with being a part of that religion or being a part of that church? Do I believe what I believe because it allows me to live the way that I want to live? Do I believe what I want to believe because it allows me to indulge in sin and nobody tells me that I can't do that? Nobody gets on my case because of the sins I'm committing. Apply a little scrutiny to your motives. Why do I believe what I believe? And at the end of the day, no matter what Demetrius says about the great goddess of Artemis and how she may fall into disrepute, at the end of the day, what does it boil down to? Money. And that's why he goes and finds the other craftsmen as well. Because he knows he has a built-in mob when it comes to people whose livelihood depends on Artemis. I understand that your livelihood doesn't necessarily depend on you being a member of the East Shelby Church of Christ. Your livelihood doesn't depend on what you think of instrumental music or baptism. Your livelihood does not depend on what you think of marriage, divorce, and remarriage. Your livelihood does not depend on what you think of leadership in the church and the role of elders and the role of preachers. Guess what? Mine does. My livelihood does. So I understand this is probably a fairly limited application to the preachers in the room, but when I look at Demetrius here in the book of Acts, I really have to look in the mirror at myself. Do I believe what I believe and preach what I preach and practice what I practice? Because if I don't, there are 5 men in this congregation who will fire me very quickly. Is that why I believe what I believe? Now, this is going to apply differently to you and whatever your situation is. But I do think Demetrius should cause all of us to look in the spiritual mirror for a little while and really consider, why do I believe what I believe? So he gathers all the other craftsmen together, all the men of similar trade, and he says that if we allow this to go on, and I like the way he says, this Paul, there's so much derision. It's like the derision is dripping out of his mouth, right? This Paul, he's trying to convince all the world that gods who are made with hands are no gods at all. I don't know. To me, I don't think Paul is the only one who can make that argument. That gods who are made with hands are no gods at all. Now, we don't have time to look at all these passages, but I recommend a couple of Old Testament passages. Isaiah 46 and Jeremiah chapter 2, as well as several others that, you know, we could talk about on some other occasion where we talk about the subject of idolatry in its own lesson. But there are a lot of passages in the Old Testament where God very plainly lays out, he says, okay, you have these gods over here, and they're encrusted with jewels, and they're made of gold, and they're made by a craftsman, and you claim that those are gods. But when you pray to them, and you cry to them, and you reach out to them, they can't help you. And when the Babylonians or the Assyrians come to burn your city to the ground, those idols are going to become spoil for the Assyrians and spoil for the Babylonians just as much as any other object. You got to pick them up and move them. You got to maintain them. You got to build them with your own hands. And I do like one Old Testament passage in particular where God says, you know, you chop a tree down and you cut it in half, and with half of the tree, you shape it, and you cover it in gold, and you turn it into a god, and the other half of the tree, you chop up and make it into firewood. How does that make any sense? And so here comes this Paul saying that gods who are made with hands are no gods at all. So should it surprise you that some of the Ephesians, at least some of them, hear a message like that and go, you know, that's not really that radical. I think Paul's right about that. That's not really that radical. And it was enough people in Ephesus, by the way, that it certainly caused Demetrius and his pals to get pretty concerned about this whole thing. So let's move on here. Let's go to verse 28 now. Verse 28 of Acts chapter 19. Now, when they heard this and were filled with rage, they began crying out, saying, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians." And you have to say it like that, too. You can't just read it. That's what you get with Ryan Goodwin as your preacher, is you not only get the word, you get the word, the dramatic reading of Acts chapter 19 along with it. But they respond irrationally. They respond in anger. And they're not the only ones. They're not the only ones. This is what I was saying at the beginning of the lesson, is sometimes when our world is turned upside down, that's cause for rejoicing. That's good news to us. To have my world turned upside down, to realize that there is something good out there, something better out there, that I can be something more than what I've been satisfied with all these years. That's good news for some people, but for other people, having their world turned upside down just causes consternation and rage, and they respond irrationally, and they form a mob because instead of confronting the falsehood itself, instead of rationally, thoughtfully confronting the falsehood, it's just easier to get angry and form a mob, which is what they do here. And so we go on here in verse 29 where it says, "The city was filled with confusion, and they rushed with one accord into the theater." Again, a theater that held 25,000 people. That's maybe some indication of how big this mob was. The fact that they went to a place that could accommodate this mob, and it's a 25,000 seat theater. I'm not saying it was 25,000 people in the mob, but it does give you some sense of this was a big enough mob that they went to the theater and viewed that as, that's our place where we're going to gather together and cry out, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians." They rushed with one accord into the theater, dragging along Gaius and Aristarchus, Paul's traveling companions from Macedonia. And when Paul wanted to go into the assembly, the disciples would not let him go. And I admire Paul, by the way. It just shows the courage of Paul, the bravery that he shows, that he's willing to put himself out there in front of an angry mob because he cares about his friends. He cares about his friends. Also, some, it says in verse 31, some of the Asiarchs, I have a note here that says political or religious officials of the province of Asia, some of the Asiarchs who were friends of Paul sent to him and repeatedly urged him not to venture into the theater. You know, these are people who are well aware of the politics of Ephesus, right? They understand, like, what's really at stake here? What kind of power does Demetrius hold? A guy like Demetrius is not a public official, but he's got a lot of sway. I appreciate, by the way, these Asiarchs, these friends of Paul. It's valuable to have useful friends. Now, I'm not saying that you should jettison friends who are useless to you, because sometimes friends are useless in some sense, you know, but their value is defined in something more than their usefulness or their utility. So I'm not saying, like, get rid of useless friends or anything like that, but I think there's value in having useful friends. These Asiarchs were people who could speak on the local politics. They could speak on what's going on in the city here. They were boots on the ground, so to speak, who could give Paul an informed and thoughtful opinion about what was going on in Ephesus. It's good to have friends who are informed. It's good to have friends who you trust who can give you good recommendations about things. It's good to have friends who will be there for you when you need someone on a resume or a letter of recommendation. It's good to have friends that are worth putting on a letter of recommendation or on a resume. It's good to have friends like that who can have your back when you need someone to have your back for you. And these Asiarchs had Paul's back. Verse 32, so then, some were shouting one thing, and some were shouting another, for the assembly was in confusion, and the majority did not know for what cause they had come together. All right, well, now we finally get to see it, don't we? Now, I promise, this is not, there's no political connotation to anything I'm saying here. Absolutely not, because the fact is that people have been rioting, people have been protesting, people have been forming a mob. That's not a new thing. That's not a 2020 thing, okay? That's an always thing. And sometimes we protest for good things, sometimes we protest for bad things, sometimes we protest peacefully, sometimes we decide that throwing flaming garbage into people's homes is the best way to handle all of our society's problems, right? So this is absolutely not a political comment, okay? People protest, people riot, people mob. That is how humans have been, at least since Ephesus in the first century, but certainly a lot longer ago than that. But I do think there's an interesting comment to be made here. Some were shouting one thing, some were shouting another. That if everybody's just kind of shouting their own thing, what's truly being accomplished here? Without a unified goal, without a unified message, the actual valuable message gets lost in the confusion. And I do think that's a sad thing is when people start causing chaos in the message gets lost. And so there may be a really powerful underlying message, but it gets lost amongst the chaos. Some were shouting one thing, some another. The assembly was in confusion, and the majority didn't even know for what cause they had come together. I think that's the real danger that we face also. That's the real danger that we face when we allow mob mentality to kind of rule our decision making, is we get people who kind of latch on, they leech on, they join the group, and it confuses the message. And I think that's a real injustice. Of course, here in Ephesus, the message is ridiculous because they're just shouting, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians!" And that seems to be the only message that they want to spread. And that makes sense. It makes sense. Now, verse 33. Some of the crowd concluded that it was Alexander, since the Jews had put him forward. And having motioned with his hand, Alexander was intending to make a defense to the assembly. But when they recognized that he was a Jew, a single outcry arose from them all as they shouted for about 2 hours, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians!" Now, I feel bad for this Alexander guy. You don't know a whole lot about him. Like, we're not really given Alexander's backstory. Like, why in the world was he put forward by the local Jewish population? But I do feel kind of bad, like, when he's kind of selected as you're going to be sort of the go-between, the mouthpiece, you're going to be the mediator. And he goes in and I'd like to make a comment here if we could all just calm down. Yes, in the back, let's go ahead and calm down. And in all one outcry, they shush him and silence him and they start crying out, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians." And we start to get to the end of the story here, so hold off just a sec. The theater probably was the only suitable place for this event to take place. It was the largest of its kind in Anatolia. The Ephesian theater could hold 25,000 spectators for a broad range of events, including plays, concerts, religious and philosophical events, and even gladiatorial combat. It is possible that Paul's preaching and Demetrius' subsequent reaction caused such a stir that this was the only facility in the city large enough for the crowd to gather. It also had the benefit of commanding the main road from the harbor and amplifying the chants and the cries from the crowd. You can't see it in this picture here, but if you were sitting in the bowl there, the half bowl of this theater, and you were looking out from the seats, you would actually see straight down the harbor road that went to the harbor, that should go without saying. Interestingly enough, Ephesus, the city, is now further from the sea than it was in the first century. Tides and the shore have shifted somewhat. And so Ephesus is no longer a port city. It has a harbor road that goes straight out to basically a field. And that's part of the reason why Ephesus as a city lost its power over the centuries, because as the port moved further and further and further away from the actual city, people just didn't have much reason to be there any longer. I do want to give you a recommendation. A friend of mine, Jeremy DeHutt, works for a production company called Appian Wave Media, and they put together Bible study videos, and it's equal parts archaeology and Bible storytelling. And he goes to sites on location. He goes to sites in the quote-unquote Holy Land of Old Testament stories, New Testament stories. He's got several video series. One of them is on Saul and David and many of the events that shaped their lives. Another video series is on the miracles of Jesus and where a lot of those miracles took place during his ministry. And he's actually in Turkey right now, or perhaps on his way home right now. He's in Turkey right now filming on location some of the cities that are talked about in the book of Acts and the New Testament. And one of them was Ephesus. He was just there a couple days ago. And so Appian Way Media, when that video series comes out, you get a little bit more information about Ephesus and some of the stories that took place there. But really, really cool stuff. It's another view there of the theater sitting up in the bowl itself. Just massive, massive theater. Let's bring our story to a close in verse 35. Now, after quieting the multitude, the town clerk said, "Men of Ephesus, what man is there after all who does not know that the city of the Ephesians is guarding the temple of the great Artemis and of the image which fell down from heaven? Since then, these are undeniable facts. You ought to keep calm and to do nothing rash." I question that. Undeniable facts? Is it really so undeniable? I think we tell ourselves that things are undeniable facts to make ourselves feel better, to feel more confident about what we believe. We just assume things as undeniable facts without actually putting them through any kind of a test of their deniability. But that's all they needed to hear to calm them down, is to just remember. Don't doubt. Don't question. Don't get angry. Just fall back into the beliefs that you've always rested on. Just fall back into the things that have made you comfortable all these years. Just trust that the way you've been living, the lifestyle, the livelihood, the beliefs, just these are undeniable facts. Don't put them to the test. Don't question. Don't be angry. Don't be rash. Leave it up to a politician to get everybody on his side, right? You claim these are undeniable facts in verse 36, so you ought to keep calm and do nothing rash. For you've brought these men here who are neither robbers of temples nor blasphemers of our goddess. And I think it's important, by the way, that when the world accuses us of wrongdoing, that we do have behavior that withstands that accusation. Peter points this out in his first epistle. He says in 1 Peter chapter 2, if you want to follow along, in 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 11, it says, "Beloved, I urge you as aliens and strangers to abstain from fleshly lusts which wage war against the soul. Keep your behavior excellent among the Gentiles, so that in the thing in which they slander you as evildoers, they may, on account of your good deeds as they observe them, glorify God in the day of visitation." And this town clerk is able to look at all these men, Demetrius and his buddies, the mob that is forming. He's able to say, "Guys, I know that Paul and Gaius and Aristarchus, I know that these Christians are irritating you. I get that. But the facts are the facts. And they've not done anything criminal. They're not robbing temples. They're not blaspheming our goddess. Their behavior is excellent. They're following the law. And if we keep this up, if we follow this path and allow mob rule to take over Ephesus, watch out. Because the Romans will come and they'll bring peace no matter what. Because there is one thing that the Romans loved more than anything else. It was peace and quiet in their empire. peace and quiet at all costs, even violence. And so he warns them, if you do anything beyond this, if you allow this to happen, if you keep going here, the Romans will come. The Romans will take away our rights, our citizenship. We don't want to have that happen to us. So in verse 41, after saying this, he dismissed the assembly. And that's the end of that story in the book of Acts. That's kind of the end of that story in Ephesus. Now we know that the church persisted there. The church grew. The church had elders. It was a fully functioning congregation. We meet those elders later on in the book of Acts when Paul talks to them in Miletus. Paul writes a letter to the Ephesians later on, a glorious and wonderful letter that gives all credit and glory and praise to God. The Ephesian church still existed near the end of the first century. It's mentioned in Revelation chapter 2 as well. Ephesus persisted in spite of everything, in spite of the culture, in spite of the business, in spite of having no cachet in their community. They persisted. They turned the world upside down. Now, they made some people angry along the way, for sure. But they turned the world upside down. Their little part of the world, at least. Can we do the same thing today? No matter what the cost, no matter the response, even if it means being dragged by a mob, even if it means a violent end to our lives, even if it means sacrificing our businesses, our livelihood, for believing and practicing not the thing that's convenient, not the thing that we've always believed, not the thing that's easy to believe, but the thing that's right. Can we do the same thing? Now, if you're not a Christian here this morning, you really ought to be. You should listen to the message of Jesus Christ, who himself said in Mark 16, verse 16, "He who believes and is baptized shall be saved." So whatever spiritual need you have, please let it be known by coming forward as we stand and sing.